You know, folks, I have a very short story that seems applicable for today, Super Bowl Sunday. There were a couple of professional football players, and they had been friends for a number of years, and one of their favorite topics of discussion was whether or not there would be football in heaven. Now, although they debated this question over and over for years, they never could reach a definitive conclusion. So because of this, they agreed that whomever passed away first would learn the answer, come back, and tell the other. Well, one day, one of these two players passed away, and sure enough, he came back with news for his friend. So he says to his friend, "I've got some good news and some bad news." His friend says, "Oh my, well, let me hear the good news first." So he replied, "Well, the good news is that yes, there is football in heaven. In fact, every Sunday is a championship game complete with solid gold rings for the winner and a stadium packed with a million screaming fans." "Wow," he said, that just sounds incredible. "How could there be a bad side?" "Well, the bad news is that you are the quarterback on Thursday." So I thought that was kind of good. All right. Well, folks, my sermon today is actually a question. It's called, "Is There a Meaning to Life?" And when I told Pastor Michael that this is what I wanted to do, he says, "Man, you've picked a very difficult subject." I said, "Yep, didn't take me long to figure that out. But I've also figured out some pretty significant answers." All right. So let's start by, let me ask you, have you heard the story about the guy who was getting ready for work early one morning? Gets up, looks into the mirror, and asks himself, "What am I doing? Why am I up at this ridiculous hour? Man, I would much rather be sleeping." But in spite of all these questions, he came to life, wolfed down some caffeine, and headed off to a job that he did not find particularly fulfilling. And after a long day of boring, mind-numbing, nonsensical routine, he went home so exhausted that he found it even hard to think. Well, the very next morning, he gets up, goes through the exact same process again. Well, the days quickly turned into weeks, the weeks became months, and then the months slipped into years. Now, even though deep down he knew inside there was something better out there was something meaningful, something lasting, a real purpose, you know, that would bring forth amazing results that would last a lifetime and beyond, he had difficulty seeing it. Right? So instead, he asked himself, "Why have I done all this? Does anything really matter?" Now, if we look at the other side of the coin for just a moment, we can ask, what if you're retired? Maybe you don't have a strong hobby or other activity to help occupy your time in a way that provides you with some personal satisfaction and meaningful fulfillment. Maybe at times you felt like our guy in the mirror. Now, whether you're retired or still among the workforce, let me ask you a couple of questions and be honest with yourself. Excuse me. Do any of these feelings sound familiar? Do you find it troubling that in years to come, nobody will remember your name or what you've done? You know, isn't the definition of insanity the act of doing the same thing over and over, yet each time expecting a different and better result? So, you know, all this leads to what may well be the most significant question ever asked of the physical world. What is the meaning of life? What are we doing here? Why are we here? And if you've ever asked yourself these questions, you know, you're certainly not alone. So I've read a lot of theologians, and this seems to be one of the most popular or frequently asked questions of all time. But if we look at this question strictly from the perspective of our own mortality, the answers we're going to see will be as varied as grains of sand upon the beach, each reflecting our own interpretation of reality. See, folks born into impoverished areas of large cities who have to struggle daily just to survive are going to see things differently than those born into suburbia. So no, our own interpretations are not where we need to be looking, because in the final analysis, life is merely a momentary blip on the radar of the time and space continuum. We're a fog that dissipates as quickly as it arrived. Now, in spite of all the self-help videos, books, speakers out there, you know, the only way to secure a lasting understanding is to turn to the book that the Creator has provided, the rule and guide of our faith, more specifically, the book of Ecclesiastes. Okay? Now, the author of this book has devoted many years of study to this very question, and he's reached some very interesting conclusions. Now, on the face, Ecclesiastes is not a happy book. It is not uplifting, and it is not cheerful. In fact, one theologian I read summed it up by saying, life stinks, and then you die. Doesn't provide much encouragement. In fact, in the New International Version, we're not going to put this on the screen because there's only three words, but Ecclesiastes, New International Version, the very first three words are, everything is meaningless. What a way to start a book. I looked at this and I thought, my gosh, here's the Bible promising salvation, love. But yet everything is meaningless, according to Ecclesiastes. So in spite of this, I have found that the answer, and there is an answer, that it does truly lie within. But before we begin, I think it's interesting that the book of Ecclesiastes has something in common with the modern-day concept of existentialism, which simply says that all there is to life is our present existence, right here, right now. Okay? To those who behold this philosophy, you know, yesterday is history. It doesn't matter. It's gone. And tomorrow doesn't matter at all because it's not even here yet. Okay? Now, I feel that whomever postulated this theory did have a partial knowledge of Ecclesiastes, but he did not follow through to its rightful conclusion. Okay? Now, I feel it's important to know a little bit about this Old Testament book before we look at the text. See, to me, the name Ecclesiastes just doesn't seem to fit in well with the other books of the Bible, such as Genesis, Exodus, Jonah, John, James, and others. To me, it sounds more like a medical term. It's like, hey, man, did you hear about the football player who tore his Ecclesiastes tendon? Yeah, he's going to be out for the rest of the season. Okay. So as I looked at this name, I thought, man, it just doesn't seem to fit. So I had to find out more about it. Okay. So now Ecclesiastes was written in the Hebrew language, and the author refers to himself as Koheleth. Now, interestingly enough, scholars are not in agreement as to what the name Koheleth really means. The root word is kale, which means to assemble. So theologians tend to suggest that Koheleth means the assembler, which through modern biblical interpretations has come to mean teacher or preacher in some cases, which to me makes more sense. Okay? Now, some theologians suggest that when the New Testament arrived, the books that we know today as the Old Testament no longer have the same meaning that they once did. But I believe that we're going to see the words of Ecclesiastes are every bit as valid as they were when they were written 3,000 years ago. So we have to ask, who is this mysterious author? Who wrote Ecclesiastes? Who is this teacher? Well, the King James Version tells us that the author is the wisest human that has ever walked upon the earth and that will ever walk upon the face of the earth, the son of King David, King Solomon. You know, apparently God came to Solomon one night in a dream and asked him what he wanted. Well, Solomon asked for an understanding heart so that he could govern well and know the difference between right and wrong. So what we have here is King Solomon. He's a student and an educator taking on this very difficult questions. So one of the things I find interesting about Solomon is that his father, King David, had overpowered Israel's enemies which left Solomon free to develop the nation. For over 40 years, Solomon reigned in peace and prosperity. Now, during this time, he built Israel's first permanent place of worship, the temple in Jerusalem. He then adds a palace and starts to fortify cities throughout his land, making them easier to defend. See, not having to be primarily concerned with military operations left Solomon breathing room to build infrastructure and study philosophies. Now, in particular, Solomon looked at four major aspects of human existence during the course of his search. He looked at work, wealth, pleasure, and the seven seasons of life. And we're going to see what he has learned and what he has to say about each one. What we're going to see overall is that he pretty much thought everything in the physical world is meaningless. He's going to say that he saw no lasting value in life. We're born, we live, and we die. Now, on its face, to me, this just seems horribly depressing. It just doesn't fit, you know. But indeed, I'll tell you what, things are not always as they appear. So instead of telling us to party like there's no tomorrow, he tells us that it is our duty and obligation to fear God and keep his commandments. Now, King Solomon starts his tutorial by telling us in chapter 1, verse 13 and 14, I quote, "I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. I have seen all the things that are done under the sun. All of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind." Now to this, he adds that generations will come and go, but that the earth remains forever. And he slams us again by declaring that no one remembers the former generations, and even those yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. Now I do see a tremendous amount of truth in this seemingly dark revelation, but I can also see a magnificent heavenly light at the end of the tunnel. Okay? So we began to examine Solomon's writings. The first thing, or first area he looks at, is work. Now, he felt this was especially significant because work is how we tend to showcase our worth to the world and is a primary factor in the processing of evaluating our individual self. Now, unfortunately, he does not see much inherent value in work as it relates to our earthly existence. See, in chapter 2, verse 18, he tells us that I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun because I must leave them to one who comes after me. Clearly, he did not like having to leave all his earthly possessions to someone who never lifted a finger to earn them. And he goes on in chapter 2, verses 22 and 23, by asking us, "What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving for which they labor under the sun? All their day's work is grief and pain. Even at night their minds do not rest. This too is meaningless." Feels like we've hit another dead-end road here. So what's next on his agenda? Well, wealth was a major factor. It's something we all tend to strive for, am I right? Well, this didn't work out too well either, and his message to us here is very short and bittersweet. He writes in chapter 5, verse 10, that whoever loves money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with their income. This too is meaningless. Again, another dead-end road, it appears. Well, so because the inherent nature of work and wealth didn't seem to provide anything positive, how about pleasure? Well, when it comes to pleasure, he apparently did not deny himself anything. He had several fine houses. He had a number of wives. He owned a variety of slaves to help care for his family, had massive quantities of flocks, and had musicians to entertain them all. He had everything a man could want, but still he saw no lasting value in any of it. But in spite of this, he did not want us to cut these things out of our lives. Now, I am personally convinced that Solomon understood that part of life's meaning is derived from our life's cycles. Excuse me. Okay. All right. He clearly tells us that there is a season for everything and a time for every matter under the sun. Now, he saw that we have seven seasons of life, and that particular number is no coincidence because in the Bible, seven is considered the perfect number. It symbolizes completion. Okay? We all know that on the seventh day, God rested, and so did his people. So, if we look at these seasons, as written within chapter 3, verses 2 through 8, excuse me, we learn that first, there is a time to be born and a time to die. There is a time to kill and a time to heal. There's a time to laugh and a time to cry. A time to scatter stones and to gather them. A time to search and a time to give up. A time to destroy and a time to mend. And a time to love and a time to hate. Now, although we get to control how we respond to these seasons and the trials and tribulations they surely bring, the timing of these events is totally out of our hands. I think what makes this so compelling is that although our time is in God's hands, he goes on to say that God has planted eternity in every human heart. We all want to know how life fits into this eternal scheme of things. So Solomon tells us that because we cannot see into the future, we therefore cannot fully understand the bigger picture of God's work. But he also tells us that the kingdom of God is both here and now in the physical world and in the heavenly world to come. It's here that Solomon wants us to know that we have to trust God more than our own understanding. You know, so if we look at the Cliff Notes version of Solomon's work, we see that he feels there is nothing better than to be happy and to enjoy ourselves as long as we can. And that people should eat, drink, and enjoy the fruits of their labor, for these too are gifts from God. Now, although we can't comprehend life seasons, we certainly can enjoy the good times when they come around and bestow these gifts of grace and love to others. So, you know, we can sum up the entire book of Ecclesiastes within chapter 12, verse 13 and 14, which says, "Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it's good or evil." All right, well, Solomon has done two very important things first. He has told us that the meaning of life is not found through the purpose, the pursuit of work. It is not found through the accumulation of wealth. It is not found through the infinite search for pleasure. And it is not found pondering the complexities of life seasons. But secondly, and if not equally important, he has shown us that the meaning of life is found through a life devoted to Christ and his teachings. Now, interestingly enough, Solomon could have made these very simple statements using just a few words. But he was a teacher, and through God's guidance and the wisdom that God gave him, he wanted us to understand the steps he took to formulate his beliefs so that we would have a greater appreciation for our responsibilities to God and his word. So the bottom line here, the question is, what can we as humans take home from Solomon's work and experiences? Well, I think while we all understand the Ten Commandments, I feel there's a lot more to be considered here. As I see it, the answer to the question, is there a meaning to life, is crystal clear. The meaning of life requires us all to use our God-given talents in the service to others. Now, while we all know members of our congregation who are quite talented, many of you have told me that you don't feel like you have any real talent to share. And hearing that was incredibly sad, and you are certainly wrong. Okay? Each and every one of us here has talent on loan from God. We just have to search within ourselves. We have to find this talent, and we have to apply it. And the thing is, you don't feel like you have to do something earth-shattering in order to be of service. Just doing something is the key. You know, if we remember what Mother Teresa said, if you can't feed 100, that's okay. Just feed one. Okay? And folks, I'm here to tell you that these pews, every one of you sitting in these pews right now, there is so much talent right here that is overflowing into the aisles. I see it every Sunday. Don't waste it. Embrace it. You know, bring forth those talents that you have, because I guarantee you there's someone out there who is going to benefit from your experience and your kindness and your grace and your love. It will happen. So I came away from my study of Solomon and this topic with a rejuvenated outlook, because using our talents today will influence and shape the lives and the lives of others for the future. And the important thing to remember about the future is that it's going to be here tomorrow. You know, God has provided countless opportunities, you know, for a substantive and fulfilling life, both on the giving and receiving end. All we have to do is recognize these talents, these gifts, for what they are, and utilize our faith and actions to the best of our ability. I submit this to you in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit.